By now, some of you are wondering when the cocktails are going to be served. You'll have to wait until you get home. Just try to suppress the urge. Every time I stand up here, I always wonder, what's the point of all this? And I discovered years ago that there really isn't any. And what I've learned to do is if I stand up here and try to pull together some themes that converge in this moment, that something improvisational will happen. Something inside us all as a community may just open. We may just be brought to a point where something will surprise us, which is hard for a group that's this educated, at some level jaded, you know, well established. You know, we like things just the way they are. But there are times in which the complexity of life asks us to look at it closely. A grasshopper is enough for some days. And so what I want to ask us to do today is to look at the question of who sets the story, who set the narrative for what we do, how we behave. And is there any way that we can, in our moment of intersection, examine that place and bring that into our hearts for a while and maybe open ourselves to surprise? Is all this vague enough? It's only 35 more minutes, folks. We'll be out of here. We have this distinguished group of musicians with us today, partly because, you know, we rehearse here, we like it. But another part of it is that we're improvising, which is to say, when I got up to do Summertime, I am working off something called a lead sheet, which is about that long, and it has a melody line and some chord symbols. And so that when we sit down to play, that's all any of us has. And from just this basic lead sheet, what we try to do is to, in our own ways, create a community of music in which we share things so that nobody dominates and that everybody gets a chance to play. And if it works, it works, and it's absolutely wonderful. If it's not, then it stinks, and sometimes it just does. It does because either we're not paying attention or somebody wants to run the thing, or, you know, it's just like any committee. But in music, it's different because we're creating an open space. And when we create the open space, we have to make ourselves available to that point that I just talked about, which is the point of surprise. What might happen? This is like a drug for us. We sit down and keep playing these old tunes over and over again, and each time there's something that happens in that tune, in that form, that allows us the moment of astonishment. In other words, we open to freedom. But in order to open to freedom, we have to have faith in the melody line, faith in one another, and faith in the possibility that something more each time is going to emerge from our playing. Follow that? Each moment is a point of convergence, so that we bring our life, our experience, our love of music to this moment and allow it to be there. It's a way of addressing a narrative and creating a narrative about summertime, blue skies, ain't misbehaving, which we'll be playing later on. That's our moral statement, by the way, in case you're interested. We hope it'll shake a few extra dollars out of your pocket as well. All right. I said, well, we're going to be talking about reflection, creativity, points of intersection. And I thought, we've all heard the great creation stories. But I said, what would Unitarians want to hear on a Sunday morning about creation? They don't want to hear about creation. They want to hear about the questions about creation, right? So we're going to look at the questions. And so I went through all the myths that I could find about creation. And I got into the Genesis myth, third chapter, familiar to all of us. Why? Because it's the first question addressed to us from the Bible. Then the man said to his wife, and then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God moving about in the orchard at the breezy time of day. Now, she's already done the thing with the fruit off the forbidden tree. And they hid from the Lord among the trees of the orchard. But the Lord called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" Like, the guy doesn't know, right? He has no idea. The man replied, I heard you moving about in the orchard, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." And possibly the most important question addressed in the book of Genesis. "And the Lord God said, 'Who told you that you were naked?'" The question, who set the narrative story about your nakedness? Okay. The Hindu creation myth is also about questions. The Rig Veda, this is meant to be sung, but you don't really want to hear me do that. Impulse from below and forward movement from above. Who really knows? Who can say? When it was born and where it came from, this creation. The gods are later than this world's creation. There, who knows where it came from and that out of which creation it came, whether it held it together or not. The one who sees it in the highest heaven, only that one knows, or perhaps that one doesn't even know. Openness. For the Hindus, always it was open. Always there's possibility. Always things are in flow. Always things are happening. So always we're left with questions, and of course one of the problems now in the culture is that our questions have become difficult and our culture complex, and so we search for meaning. And when we come to a place like this on a Sunday morning, we are concerned about it. We're trying to make place in our life largely for a world that we no longer understand. And perhaps as we examine that, we look at the understandings that we've had for years and are aware that maybe there's some things there that we might want to look at and we might want to examine. So the core of this moment for many of us is to say, who set the narrative out of which we live and move and have our being? Who set the narrative that says that we do this, that, or the other thing, or how we dress, or how we live, or what we read, or what we eat? It seems that something is driving us, and I'm not sure what it is, but we seem to be propelled by a lot of systems that are kind of crumbling under their own weight. Systems have placed themselves within us, within the fiber of our culture, within our society, even within our bodies, about what it means to be human and what it means to value that. And in the process, it seems that the process has taken over just about everything, and we seem to be left out. So that the culture in which we live no longer even sees us or even knows who we are. And that our knowledge to adapt to this movement, to adapt to this culture, is distancing itself from the culture itself. And so we look at generations who have followed us, who are following us, and we see them, we see our children, we see our grandchildren, and we're aware that they're formed very differently from a lot of us, and that their values, while similar to ours, may in some respects be very different. Our daughter, who is 28, is a school psychologist, and she says, "Dad," she says, "the kids in middle school are very different from us. I don't know who they are." And so we're in a complex age with complex values, appearing to be driven by a narrative that keeps pushing, keeps shoving, keeps moving us forward, and we're not sure where we're going with any of it. Make sense? People are doing this, I guess. I fooled you so far. So that brings us to the whole business of improvisation and what does it mean to... How did I get into music is another... Well, I started out playing music when I was a kid because my parents were musicians. My father sang and my mother played piano. She played in silent films. And so I picked up a lot of the early music of the 20th century and have used that in a lot of this kind of music from the 30s and 40s and 20s was the stuff that she enjoyed playing at home. And so I grew up with it, and it's very comfortable for me. And at the age of 16, I had my union card, and I was playing for money. I played through college, through graduate school, played in D.C. I don't have a degree in music. I've just studied with other people, and I pay attention. And I played in D.C. in the 60s when there was a lot of money and a lot of interest in what was then called stereo and hi-fi, and people were buying a lot of recordings and playing them at home, and there was a huge appetite for live music. And so I was busy all the time playing stuff. But I was playing classical music. Now, I've got to confess, I don't read music very well. There's something inside my mind that when I see music, I can see the line going up and down, but I can't figure out what the rhythm is. And I faked it I faked most of my life. We all do. I faked it by having my teacher hum stuff or play it, and then I have a good oral memory for retaining the stuff, and that's kind of how I've got along. But it's a complex age, and as much as I loved jazz and working in that medium in the 60s, there was no place to study it, and the only way to study it was, or to learn it was to go on the road with a band, and I really wasn't ready to spend my entire life in drugs, sex, and rock and roll. I mean, a few minutes would be nice, but, you know, not the whole life. I went away, studied theology, was ordained in 1973, and spent most of my career at Bruton Parish downtown, as some of you know, until there was a great collision with a huge lawsuit 11 years ago in which a 16-year-old kid was convicted of abusing some children, a lot of them. And it was interesting because it was a very comfortable setting for me. I knew who I was, I knew who everybody else was, and you know, it was a steady kind of solid, people come to Williamsburg to find a solidity. They want to be here because it has a traditional setting. They don't want to deal with the complexity of change and all the things that are going on. And that's why a lot of us retreat to a place like this until all of a sudden it gives way. But I found myself asking more questions than I had answers for at that point, dealing with complexities for which I was not trained, and watching the staff sort of disappear. I had no part in the suit, but I was kind of a guilty bystander, caught in the process of this thing going on. And about a year, about the middle of 1995, I said, or 96, I can't do this anymore. And I went to the bishop and I said, I'm burned to the ground, I need to get out, I don't know what I'm going to do. And the bishop said, should I assign you to another parish? Do you want to go someplace else? I said, no, I just need to get out. And I'll leave the light on. That's like Motel 6, leave the light on for me. And that's sort of where we left it. And I went out, not because I had to. But I also, as I left, was aware that I wanted to de-roll from the clergy thing. Because it carries so many burdens with it. And I noticed that in the paper yesterday, the religious column in the Daily Press, a man named Booth from Hampton University wrote a column about how clergy sort of self-destruct and let themselves be chewed up by parishioners. You know, it happens. It's tough. This is a place where, because it's all voluntary, we can and do allow ourselves more freedom of expression. And that's good because it has to be. There's got to be some place where we can take the complexities of culture, come to a place where it's safe, where we're loved, where we're trusted, and say, I'm totally lost. And that's what happened. I finally had to say, I'm totally lost. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I went out to Busch Gardens, and I said, I play keyboard. Do you need anybody? I blew smoke at the music director forever, trying to get a job, and he gave me one. He didn't know I couldn't read the score, but that's all right. He said, okay, go over to costumes, get suited up, and you can do 6 shows tomorrow starting at 10 o'clock. And I did. And, I was terrified. No rehearsal, nothing. Just went in, did the show cold. But I know, as any of us who learned to kind of adapt to culture, I just watched, I paid attention, and I figured it out. And I had a wonderful time. And I spent 8 years at Busch Gardens being a musician and learning to do things that I never imagined I could do or wanted to do. The art of improvisation for me came when I realized that somewhere out of my theological base, there was living within me somewhere a big piece of what we lovingly refer to as Virginia Ham. And I couldn't see it. You can see it now. I mean, all you're watching is a theme park entertainer here who has a theological background. That's all. I could sell you drinks. I mean, I could do anything to you right now. All I'm doing is I'm just standing here improvising. But that wasn't easy for me because I was a sit-down and play musician. And so I sat down and played until the company said, you're going to do something different. And so they pushed me into playing a polka show at the Fest House. By this point, I had prostituted myself totally and said, yes, I'm an accordion player. I hadn't picked up an accordion in 40 years. But when you're a professional musician, you never say no. You just keep showing up and playing whatever they tell you to. You take the check and run. So I did it, and I had a wonderful time. Finally, toward the last two or three years, I played the violinist Susan, and we worked with Bob Bauman, who was the Burgermeister at the Fest House. Some of you may remember him. He was a wonderful man who worked until he was 87. He was a marvelous entertainer, a wonderful singer, and a wonderfully warm human being. So I learned a lot watching Bob, and so they turned us loose on the street in all the countries of Busch Gardens to improvise and play music. And I remember my first time out, I was in Ireland. I had no idea what I was doing, except I knew I had 25 minutes to fill. I died. I mean, half of New Jersey is gathered. And your job is to, as they say in the sideshow trade, you have to buttonhole them. You pull them in and keep them busy and entertain them for a while. I didn't know what to do, you know. What do I do? Recite offertory sentences from the Book of Common Prayer? How am I going to make this thing work? Well, over the years, I learned that I have 27 bad jokes that I can tell. You've heard most of them, one point or another. And a desire to engage people in that moment just the way they are. They're just, you know, sunburned people from New Jersey. Well, what are you going to do? Play When Irish Eyes Were Smiling, or whatever it is that you want to do to link these people into some kind of live show business. That's another issue, because most people don't know what to do with live entertainers. So I had a wonderful time, but I remember saying about the first week or so, I couldn't figure out how to do this. And it's similar. Remember my gorilla story, anybody? It's that same thing. I just had no idea how to do this. I had to think about it. And the supervisor, my theater supervisor, came by, and we had just finished a show. It was 11 o'clock in the morning. And I said, Emil, this thing went down the cosmic commode. It was gone before I started. I was sweating bullets. The thing looked terrible. I couldn't figure out anything. And she says, well, it's 11 o'clock. She says, you've got to do it again at 12:30. Now, if that one flushes down the dumper, you can do it again at 2. And if that doesn't work, you've got 3:30. And if you don't like that, you can do it again at 5. She says, you'll get it. Connection, music, joy, the things that are so much a core of what is about, what it's about to be human. To put that out there in front of a group of strangers is the toughest thing in the world, until you realize that deep at the base of all of it is the joy of what it means to be a human being. What sets the narrative over the top of us is this incredible amount of concern, all this stuff that's going on, all these things in the world, all this stuff in the White House. And the news thing is, you know, Mr. Cheney, his operating narrative is keep it secret. Don't tell anybody. I'll make up something, you know. We don't know what's going on. A community like this is about finding the core that is beneath, beyond all of that stuff that seems to be propelling the culture forward. The master teacher Jesus says it's all within us. But what is that that's within us? It suggests it's an ability, or at least an inclination, to want to improvise ourselves toward joy, to want to improvise ourselves to a place where things are more open. I thought about some things about this who controls the narrative and about improvisation and about what musicians do when they're sitting together. And the first thing that came to me was that we have a certain reverence for uncertainty. It's not that we're not afraid of it sometimes, but we're aware that uncertainty is a part of what it means to engage a group of musicians together and just put out whatever the product is. Some of you may remember Park and Betsy Rouse. Betsy was an incredible character. Her husband ran the Jamestown Foundation years and years ago. He was a writer, a newspaper columnist, and just a generally interesting man. And one time I was standing out in front of Bruton Parish, and Betsy was one of my biggest fans, and she came up to me one Sunday, and Betsy was very abrupt. She was right in your face. So you remember her? She grabbed me by the front of my vestment and pounded on my chest. And she said, "You'd have made a wonderful bishop, but you won't follow the rules." Betsy, I don't know what most of them are. A reverence for uncertainty, to be in the presence of life and to be aware that there's something deep within it that's calling us to a greater degree of safety than we can understand, the peace that passes all understanding. Secondly, I probably got a whole outline for a course. We're embodied here, and this is a really difficult thing. We can feel the stress of whatever the normative message is that is just taking us and wringing us out. And so we watch the news at 6:30 and all of these pills that are supposed to cure our ills. In the meantime, our body is just churning with a lot of bad information about who we are and whose we are. And I suggest that part of that is just learning to be aware that we are in stress and trying to find some way not just to deal with it, but to look at the message that makes us feel this way and to realize that that message is a lie. The message is a lie. We are here because it's safe to be here, no matter what we're feeling. And so there's a question there, a big Unitarian question about, do we really need to live with all this stress? And my first point is, do we need to live with all these rules? A third point, there are four, is that we're conscious human beings. We came from a past into a present and into a future that meets us here in this moment. And as people of concern, we have to look at the possibility that consciousness is always called to expand. Consciousness doesn't contract, no matter what Rush Limbaugh says. We are not going backward. We're not staying where we are. And this particular community is always upholding up the value of diversity. It's got to happen. It's the rule of music. We have to keep engaging ourselves to open and improvise our way into a more diverse community. Finally, we live in chaos. Now, for me it's a scary word. For physicists, it's not. It means that we are called to engage life in a marvelously spontaneous way. It doesn't mean disorder. Chaos simply means that there's a source of creation. There's a source of creativity. And as communities of concern, we can bring ourselves to the place where we can be at the point of creativity without fear. One of you pointed out, I have a sermon illustration about children. If I have a group of 4 or 5 year old kids, and you say to a group of 4 year old, 5 year old kids, can you dance? Oh, yes, we can dance. Can you draw a picture? Yes, we'll draw a picture. Can you sing? Yes. Can you play a musical instrument? Yes. And then something happens. That there's a story, there's a place in which some narrative takes them over and says to them, you can't do that. We've got standards. We've got rules. You can't possibly do that. And so that's enough. Well, I think it is. I mean, you may want more, but I'm not too interested. And my feet are getting tired, and I'm ready to sit down. I found this in a book, a music book written by a scholar. He says, improvising musicians do more than relish the subtle uncertainties that keep a musical composition or performance feeling fresh and vital. Uncertainty is our reason to be. The word improvisation is derived from Latin in, not provisus, not foreseen. Improvisers not only welcome, but worship the sound of surprise. They revere the uncertainties of new techniques, new conceptions, new performance occasions, groupings, and venues. During performance, improvisers also must revere the process of exploring and negotiating uncertainties together. Next to my computer and my keyboard, I keep this. Professional musicians, this is just an aside. Hunter Thompson, the Gonzo journalist, said this. The music business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good people die like dogs. There is also a negative side. So, I would leave you with two quotes from that don't ever answer the question, but give me a suggested way out. Miles Davis says, don't play what's there, play what's not there. And the great Duke Ellington says, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. So be it. Amen.